Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Has environmentalism failed? If so, what do we do next? That's the question faced by three panelists, former Ecologist magazine deputy editor Paul Kingsnorth from the UK, American deep green activist and writer Liera Keith, and eco-philosopher David Abram. The host of this web conference is Eric Hoffner of Orion magazine.
The thing that's occurred to me and the thing that I tried to write about in the essay and that we talk about quite a lot in the Dark Mountain Project as well is the fact that, that this stuff is inevitable. This is the system trying to keep itself going. There's an enormous machine. You can call it civilization, industrialism, whatever you want to call it. We all know what it is. It's faced with any number of problems, from economic collapse to ecological collapse to peak oil to whatever. And it's going to try and keep itself going through any means necessary. And whether that involves slaughtering the people of the Niger Delta or whether it involves whacking mirrors all across the Sahara Desert, they're going to do that. And if they have to call it sustainability, then they'll call it that. But that's got nothing to do with what we're actually talking about. So in terms of how to counter that, I think the first thing to do is to stop expecting it not to happen and to stop, being surprised in some ways. I mean, this is the instrumentalism of the machine just doing what it does. And, what you do to stop it is you could do anything from putting yourself in the way of it to talking about it differently. I mean, some of this stuff is about language, I find. And we've allowed ourselves as environmentalists or whatever we want to call ourselves to have our language taken away from us in terms of how we talk about this stuff. I mean, this is one of the things that just made me flee from this so rapidly, is that I hear mainstream environmentalists talking like businessmen, talking like economists, pretending to talk like scientists, talking like these kind of dried out technocrats, and obsessing over carbon to the exclusion of all other issues. And if you allow that to happen, if we allow that to happen, then this will be the result. People won't talk about beauty. They won't talk about love. They won't talk about the kind of solidarity with the rest of life that David was talking about. And, if we just sit here silently doing nothing and saying nothing in our own words, then this stuff will just march all over the place. And I think that as things start to fall apart, which they're doing, it will just become more and more desperate, and there'll be more of this, and a new way of seeing, a new way of talking, or maybe a very old one, would make a difference, I think.
Nancy's dialed in through the webinar platform, and she says, well, but what about recent efforts like 350.org fighting the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline? And, of course, it looks like, as a side note, President Obama might be caving in on that, but she goes on, Are they misguided that this is an ineffective strategy, or do we just need dozens and hundreds of more efforts like these?
I would say that it's a good beginning, and clearly those people are working really tirelessly, so I'm certainly not going to criticize them, because we need action sort of at every level of the spectrum. And so I think mostly what 350.org at this point, what they've been really good at is raising public awareness and a certain amount of witnessing. So that kind of symbolic arrest at the White House is a form of witnessing. But we need to step it up. And that means that we need to be using civil disobedience in the way that it's meant to be used. And that is actually to obstruct something, to actually put your body in the way of the harm that's happening. So that's why, like at Deep Green Resistance, we're having a whole summer of campaigns. We actually intend to shut down an oil refinery, and we need to show people how civil disobedience should be done. It's like one of our best techniques for political change, and it's been gutted over the last 30 years, and I don't really understand it. I mean, people used to know how to do civil disobedience, and it's been turned into this very bizarre symbolic act now. It's not meant to be symbolic. It's meant to actually obstruct, because you're using bodies instead of weapons, right? But you need to stop something bad that's happening, and so that's what we intend to do. And I would really encourage people to read about the history of civil disobedience and the ways that it's been used. Gene Sharp, is the main theorist of civil disobedience as a form of direct action. But we need to think like real strategists. And to me, the main division is not between, say, violence and nonviolence. It's really between people who are willing to do something and people who are willing to do nothing. So people who are willing to face down power and people who will buckle and will not face down power. And that's really the main division. I mean, from there, it's all just a matter of tactics. And you look at what you've got and you look at what you're up against and you decide whether you have what it takes to use civil disobedience correctly. But again, that main division is not between, violence and nonviolence. It really is between confronting power or submitting to power.
I would just agree with that wholeheartedly. Yeah, I think 350 is doing some great work. Of course, it's darn useful. We just need gobs and gobs and gobs of other approaches being put to work as well.
Now, Bob has written in by email and says, does Paul Kingsnorth or the others for that matter feel that in the alliance between the Occupy movement and things like 350.org, the climate change message will be lost in the social justice agenda of the left? Or is there hope of a genuine realignment of the political beast to include eco-justice as a primary value, as Naomi Klein recently argued in The Nation?
It's interesting this. I wrote a book 10 years ago called One No Many Yeses, which was all about global social justice movements, actually, which is just, it's strange because this was at the time of Seattle and the few years after that where the equivalent of the Occupy movement went all around the world. And then it disappeared in the war on terror and the new crackdowns on activists and all the rest of it. Right. And now it's coming back again. And the reason it's coming back again in the West, in places like the States, in places like Britain, is that we're being squeezed in the way that the poor have been squeezed for the last 40 years. Stuff like this has been going on across the so-called third world for quite a long time, you know, pretty much in every country in Latin America for 20 years. And it's going on here now because we can see the injustice in our own countries, and we can see the injustice growing and the inequality growing, and we're losing our public services and all the rest of it. Now, that's a slightly different issue to the one we're talking about, which is not to say that they have to be separate and all the rest of it, and they can't be connected, but that this stuff is primarily about how this model of civilization is falling apart and how we're taking the fallout, and we want to stop that happening, which is perfectly good and legitimate, but I think it's a slightly different thing. And of course, I think this is the point I was trying to make in the essay, maybe clumsily, about social justice and environmental justice and how they should go hand in hand, but they often don't. It'd be very easy to envisage a world in which we had maybe equality and social justice and virtually everything that wasn't human was dead. And this is the paradox. It is why you have to try and work these things out. I mean, I also think, by the way, that the climate change messages has actually crowded out all other so-called environmental messages, and that's one of the problems, actually. I mean, we've got so obsessed with climate change because it's the biggest threat to the system, and it's the biggest threat to our lives, and it's very symbolic, and it's very real. And, you know, almost everything that you hear about now when you hear the word environmentalism will be a discussion about reducing emissions in some way, as if that were the only thing to concern ourselves with, as if that were the only environmental threat, and as if the only solution to it was a technological one about what machines we can invent to get us out of the mess. You know, I have concerns about the so-called climate justice movement anyway, because I think it's missing a lot of the points. I don't think it's surprising, because we live in such a sort of narcissistic techno-industrial society that we can't see outside it, and that's the stuff that David touches on. But I don't know. I think that we're just undergoing a collapse at the moment, and we have to try and keep this stuff in mind, because the thing that worries me, of course, is that when we're going through a collapse as humans, as individuals, we'll focus on ourselves and what we need and what we want and what we want to prevent for ourselves from losing. And that's a time when it's very easy to lose sight of anything that doesn't immediately affect you.
Mm. Yeah, and the other thing, or I guess what you're implying about climate change as such a single overarching issue, is that, well, it's mighty global, and so it takes attention and everybody's focus away from their visceral engagement with the earth immediately around them, with the specific particulars, the critters, the losses of particular animals, and losses of habitat right here. What's happening to the soil. And it's also so abstract. It's a language of statistics and chemistry that we're all speaking that also steals us away slides us away from our direct experience, our felt encounter with what really gets us in the gut. And I hear that. I want to say one thing, though, in response to this question of social justice. I mean, we know we're heading into... No, we're already living in a time of mounting cataclysms, and things are going to get yet really hard and harder and then harder and then harder still and fairly rapidly. It seems to me the easiest human reaction to such hardship is to start looking for somebody to blame and try to hurt them or destroy them or make them feel pain. You know, the scapegoat impulse, and we've seen so much evidence for this in the bloody century that's just passed. So I'm really concerned with how to short circuit that impulse. And I'm actually pretty darn glad that some real social reflection and Marx's analysis, too, began to infiltrate the ecological movement, because I think we really needed to begin to include human beings and human communities deeply within our understanding of the wild biosphere. Hmm. But what the left is needing to understand and to begin to understand a lot more is just how profoundly human well-being and human justice is dependent upon the exuberant and wild flourishing of the local earth and of other animals, of the wetlands and the woods. I think we're human only in contact with what is not human, by which I mean we are human and humane only in contact and conviviality with what ain't human.
Mm, that's a really interesting point.
I'll leave it there. Yeah.
I want to just add something about the Occupy movement as well. I mean, if we understand what capitalism is, it's a system that takes living creatures and their homes, and it declares them private property, and then it turns them into dead commodities, and then it accumulates those commodities into wealth. So this is a pyramid scheme of death. And I think that's self-evident that, you know, capitalism is the 1% taking from the 99%. But we have to add to that that, you know, 98% of the world's old-growth forests are gone, and 99% of the prairies are gone. And that means 99% of the pox flowers, and 99% of the prairie dogs, and 99% of the bison. The wealth is created from their dead bodies. The point is not to redistribute that wealth. The point is to stop the death while there's still something left alive.
Sure.
And I think that that is a real, that's a real division point in the Occupy movement. And that's going to be true of any broad-based social movement. You're going to have people who pull to the center and then people who pull to way more radical perspectives. And right now, as long as they're just protesting that they've lost some of their middle-class entitlements, they just want to redistribute the wealth. But I want the more radical side to win, which is to say it's not about redistributing that wealth, it's about stopping that wealth, which is to say it's about stopping the death.
Caroline says, now David has come closest to my observation in this talk about transformation, shape-shifting, morphing culture, and I wonder why I haven't yet heard the word sacred. When did sacred become a dirty word? The ecology movement did once have a spiritual thread, like with Thoreau, Muir, and Leopold. It's a spiritual depth that's transformative. So what is this word, you guys? What do you make of sacred in context of this movement?
I'm sure David can talk about it better than me, so I'll just briefly say that I think that word disappeared when we all started pretending to be very serious in relation to the stuff we were just saying about how climate change and the sort of these particular technocratic approaches colonize the movement. If you decide that climate change is the problem and you've got to get that sorted with policy and technological fixes pretty quickly, then you better put a suit on and start talking to the movers and shakers, and you better stop talking about the sacred, because they're not going to listen to you. And you know, it's an example of a colonizing of language, I think, to some degree. If you want to walk with the power brokers, if you want to walk with the guys to get things done, you know, you can't talk like that, because they don't they just laugh at you. That's my observation anyway.
I don't have much to whether or not we're using the term. That's what each of us is speaking of here, and it's very much what I hear in Lierre's comments. She's speaking very directly from the sense of the sacred. I can't help but hear it that way. And when you're willing to put your body on the line, your life on the line, it's because of your sense of something sacred that is being violated in a horrific way. I think that's what we're all on about here.
Now, how about Hugh? He wants to know, do you imagine a graceful way forward as opposed to a path of total collapse in a world of struggle among the survivors? Doesn't sound like a pleasant scenario, except from a reduced capacity of humans to degrade systems. David referred to a transformation of culture. So what of that? Is there a graceful way forward? Anyone?
Personally, I very much doubt it. I think if you're looking for pleasant scenarios at this point in time, you're going to be disappointed. I think that it's impossible to predict what's going to happen, but we know, as David just said, that we're already in a kind of unraveling here. Things are already collapsing. We can see that. Lots of us are still in denial about it, but we won't be able to be for much longer. So we have to sort of pick our way through that. I think that one of the problems I keep coming across is not necessarily with this question, but with others, is that people seem to think that there has to be a solution to every problem. It just has to be because we want there to be. And secondly, that we have to have a sort of global approach. There has to be a global plan. so that we can, you know, we can stop things, stop bad things happening, and make it global and roll it out. And I just, you know, it's not going to happen. So we have to focus in on what we can do most effectively, given that. And that's not the same thing as giving up at all. It's almost the opposite of giving up, actually. The only thing it's giving up on is a sort of false hope, as far as I see it. But yeah, it's there's no easy way out of it for me. I don't think that it's going to be an easy century at all. We're all going to have to live through. And I think those of us, it's interesting. Some people say, well, we live in the rich world and we're going to be shielded from it better than the poor. I'm not sure that's necessarily true, actually. I think that we live in a lot of us in cultures like this live in quite profound isolation from each other. We have very few actual practical skills. We were entirely dependent on the machine to get our food and our energy and everything else. If that starts falling apart in any way, we're in big trouble very quickly. So I actually don't believe that any of us is going to escape some great difficulties, which will make us open our eyes if we haven't opened them yet.
I mean, all the ways in which the system is cracking and springing leaks and breaking down, they'll open the way for all sorts of other possibilities
to
come trickling in or flooding in. I think we know very little about what is possible. I don't think it's going to be very graceful. I think it's going to be clumsy and mighty ugly, inevitably, in many facets. But I take that last question as a question about how we work to stop this thing. And it's a big question that I have, because when we ask people to now, you know, come in, when we put out a call for warriors and we say, this is a war, and if you feel yourself as a warrior, that's powerful and likely to bring in a lot of good folk, but I think it's also likely to bring on board a lot of folks who join the effort for their own meanness or their own unmetabolized anger, and they just want to destroy stuff. And I don't have a lot of faith that can really be put to good use. It seems much more likely to bring on the kinds of internecine violence that would both ravage the human world, but deeply ravage the more than human terrain alongside and just fill it with blood. So it's a question, a sincere question, Lear.
I guess I feel like it's already filled with blood. That, you know, when another day goes by and there's 200 species gone, I don't know how much worse it could get. The culture is completely destroying every last living thing, and they're not going to stop till it's all dead. The soil is going to be baked of bacteria by the time this is over if we don't stop it. So I guess I just don't feel the same reservations. We need to stop this. You know, the plankton populations are collapsing in the ocean, and I guess plankton are too small and green for most people to care about, but I'll tell you that 2 out of 3 animal breaths is made possible by the oxygen that they produce. So if the oceans go down, we're going down too. And that's what I mean when I say every last living thing. They're not going to stop till it's all over. You know, where I see a lot of, I guess the only place where I really draw more inspiration is from the fact that the world will repair itself if we just get out of the way. And, I mean, they're scrambling around out there trying to come up with all these technological fixes, but frankly, the world will repair itself if we just stop destroying. And, you know, my favorite statistic on this is that if we could repair the grasslands the world over, even 75% of the world's rangelands, which have been destroyed by agriculture, let's be very clear, but if we could restore them to prairie, it would only take about 15 years, and the carbon would be down to 233 parts per million, which is way below that, I'm sorry, 323, that's way below that 350 mark. And it would only take 15 years, and that's how good, you know, grass is at building soil. Of course, the building block is carbon. So all we have to do is stop destroying. I mean, the world wants to be a grassland, and it wants to be a forest, and it really wants to be a wetland. And we could help that process happen quicker, but honestly, if we just get out of the way, it will happen. And we could sequester all that carbon. You know, we don't have to go through this next century of hell. So the solutions are actually, you know, just for us to stop being these sort of monstrous creatures that civilization has created. I mean, we lived on this planet for 4 million years and we didn't destroy things. So it's really only 7 places where civilization began. And, you know, I get that it's now the dominant system, but we know other ways to be. And there are still people alive today who have held on to their cultures and know better ways. And I'm sure they'll teach us if we ask them humbly. So that part doesn't actually concern me. It's just, I think we have to stop this machine. And I don't,
it's just, I think we're in deep,
in deep agreement on many aspects of this. It's just how most effectively, strategically, tactically, to stop it. And if one really applies violence to this incredibly violent system, whether that doesn't, in fact, stop it, but just sets up a snowballing violence, whether there might be yet more strategic ways of morphing it, shape-shifting it. And I know you, just from things you've said in this conversation, clearly support widespread nonviolent civil disobedience. I think there's ever more possibilities suddenly for that opened up by the Occupy movement. I just think if we have in our minds the vision of just bringing something to a halt through some sort of violent breakdown, I don't think that's real. It's just, to me, I've not seen any evidence in my life that the sudden stoppage of any force actually brings a kind of quietude afterwards. I'm more given to a logic of metamorphosis, I guess. I can't help it. My background is that of a magician. I think that there is a logic to the world very different from that to which we've been educated. Yeah, it's not entirely rational, that's for sure. I think that nature or this breathing biosphere lives and moves by a logic that does not move by straight lines and right angles and goes through dramatic shape or phase shifts at certain moments when one least expects it. Again, I don't think we know all that much about what's possible.
You are listening to an Orion Magazine webcast, Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, on Radio EcoShock. Here's your host, Eric Hoffner.
Well, let me bring this back around to Paul Kingsnorth with the last question. And it concerns the last two paragraphs of your article, which, you know, people reacted to very in many ways. So Douglas wants to know, Paul, can you please speak more about your last two paragraphs where you say, I withdraw from the campaigning and the marching?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I wrote this piece. So I did withdraw, actually, for quite a long time, and I'm still quite withdrawn from it. And what I mean by that is that I've withdrawn from the kind of stuff that I used to do. I've withdrawn from all of the sort of lobbying and the campaigning to stop climate change and all of the kind of mainstream stuff that we've been talking about here, because I don't think it works. And a lot of people said to me, particularly all the environmentalists who are still at it, who felt attacked by that, unsurprisingly, well, you're just giving up then. And, you know, what use is that? You're giving up. And I said, I'm not giving up, except in the sense that I'm giving up on stuff that doesn't work. And I think it doesn't work because I've been doing it for 15 years, and I don't think we've got hope of making it work. So it's the withdrawal. It was really, for me, a sense of going out and going in and trying to think about what I was doing, going back to first principles, which comes down to a lot of the stuff that David has said here, which I think is so important. Because another criticism I got from this essay is, oh, you know, this is just romantic. What's all this? What use is all this romantic nonsense about how beautiful hills are? You know, we haven't got time for that. We've got to save the world. And I think, as David says, if you don't have a passion for life in whatever form that comes to you, whether it's through a love of the hills that you're walking on, or the tree outside your window, or this sense of a great web of species that's disappearing, whatever it is, if you don't have a felt, sensuous, emotional attachment to something, then I don't think you're going to have any concern for it or love for it at all. I think that's where all of it starts, or should start. And I think if you've got any kind of environmental movement that doesn't start from that place, that just starts from a dry analysis of numbers, then you're in big trouble, and that's what we've ended up with. So the sense of withdrawal, which I have gone through, and which actually led me to start up the Dark Mountain Project, which is a kind of cultural and literary response to ecocide and collapse, was a sense of, as I say, going back to first principles. What is this about? Well, this is about what all of us have been talking about here. We've got this huge web of incredible life, and we're destroying it all. And what are we going to do about that? How are we going to live through it? How are we going to stop it if we can? And the answers to that will be different for all of us, depending on what we're good at and what we believe we can do and what our strengths are. But there's no it isn't a turning away from it, because none of us can afford to do that. In whatever we're good at, what we can't afford to do is turn away from all of the things that we've been talking about here, this great eco side. We've got to face it down, whatever emotions it brings to us, and go through and try and play our part in stopping it in whatever way we can.
Thanks. Well, we ought to begin to wrap up now. Any further thoughts, Liara and David, to share with us?
I would just like to end by quoting Frederick Douglass, who's one of my favorite people from history. And he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say what a pleasure it is to be on the phone with really splendid souls.
That's always nice, isn't it?
Yeah, and who aren't afraid to stare hell in the face. That's a darn good first step. And let's move. Let's move.
Paul, anything to leave us with?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that I think in a strange way I'm more hopeful than I was when I wrote this piece. I mean, it fluctuates day by day depending on what I've seen, you know, as I'm sure it does for all of us. But the hope for me comes from the fact that, as David was alluding to as well, this, everything's splintering now. The system's falling apart in all sorts of different ways. We're going through a huge, huge change that we can only barely begin to comprehend. And we see, you know, parts of it in our everyday life in the way that our economies are contracting or falling apart. But it's so much bigger than that. I mean, I think that just even if you do isolate climate change and talk about that, the Earth appears to be moving to a new state, and it's probably too late to stop it. And it's done it many times before in its history. And if that's the case, we're going to have to move with it in some way. But what we're not going to be able to take with us is this whole huge industrial edifice that we've built up. So I don't think it's even an option to imagine that that will last too much longer. And what its end will look like and how long it will last, I don't know. But we're clearly in this time of huge change. And when that happens, when the cracks appear, all sorts of things start growing through them. And I think it's true, actually, that we don't know what the possibilities will be. And I don't think that means we should go away feeling smug and thinking that everything will be fine, because it won't be. It will be very far from fine. But I think there are probably going to be possibilities to change this thing that we haven't seen yet. I feel like we're kind of in between two paradigms at the moment, and we don't quite know what the new one's going to be. So it's probably good for us all to remain alert and just keep talking about this stuff, and keep doing what we're all doing and what everyone listening will be doing as well, because it's just, you know, it's too important not to, I think.
Mm. Fantastic. Thank you. Now, Orion's live web events are made possible by subscriptions to Orion and by your donations, so please go to orionmagazine.org/donate. to support our efforts to bring people together for conversations like this one. Thanks very much, Paul, Liara, and David, for your thoughts today. This is Eric Hoffner of Orion Magazine signing off. Take care. Keep in touch.
You've just heard a web conference called Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, written by the UK writer and green iconoclast Paul Kingsnorth. Other panelists were David Abram and Liara Keith. We've had Paul Kingsnorth on Radio EcoShock. Check out that interview in our program archives at ecoshock.org. I'll also post a link in our show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul recently announced he is leaving the climate movement. I can't do that. My kids and grandson need me to keep trying, to go down in defeat, if I must. My thanks to Eric Hoffner and to Orion Magazine for putting together this brilliant discussion. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.